Brew Strong is brought to you by Blickman Engineering, home of the top-tier brewing stand. Visit them online at blickmanengineering.com.
Brewers, it's time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters. And my buddy, John Palmer.
Still on break, I guess.
Still on break. greetings.
Yeah.
Greetings.
This is Palmer. I think the family's home. He has to keep turning his microphone off there.
Yeah, unfortunately, he couldn't be in the studio today. But he's still there in spirit. Today, I want to thank our fine sponsor, like every other show we do, is John Blickman at BlickmanEngineering.com. Those guys, they are making, they put the geeky in homebrew equipment. And not that they're, I don't know. You know, one of the things that's really cool to me about Blickman Engineering is that they're always thinking, you know, about how people use their equipment and what the problems people are experiencing and how to solve those problems. And I think that's what good engineering does. It's not, oh, here's something we can sell. It's here is a solution to a problem that a lot of people experience. And by providing the solution, people will have an easier time of brewing. They'll have you know a better result, and you know because of that, people want to buy it, and we'll make a living, and you know they'll be happy that they spent the money. And that's one of the cool things about Blickman. I think you know they're always looking. You know, does the product you know solve a problem? And I think that's just ultimately cool. So I'm really thrilled that they're the sponsor of the show. They pay for this, so you don't have to. So make sure you get yourself over to BlickmanEngineering.com or go down to your local homebrew shop and say, hey, you know, you got some Blickman gear here I can look at. I want to see, you know, how cool this is. You know, Jamal keeps talking about how cool it is. I want to see it for myself.
There you go.
You know, check out any other gear, and I think you'll be surprised at the quality and efficiency of the gear. So, greetings.
Hey, greetings. Yeah, just I was out admiring my Blickman equipment.
Nice.
Yeah, I heard a little psst go off, and you know.
Yeah, had a run downstairs.
You're really admiring it to the extreme there.
Yeah. Take a picture and all that.
You know. All right. If you get a chance, also swing by the Brewing Network store. Good stuff there. I'm wearing, if you got the cameras running today.
No cameras today.
Because I'm ugly. That's it. Right? Well, I put on a few pounds.
You know?
It's the bedhead, Jimmy.
I'm wearing my Brew Strong shirt, like I do for most Brew Strong shows.
Yeah.
One of the arm ones. And if you get yourself to the Brew Network store, you can have one too. They also got Brew Strong hats.
Yeah.
Brew Strong shirts.
Two different styles of Brew Strong t-shirts. A couple different colors.
Brew Strong thongs.
Not yet.
An official no pants Brew Strong wear?
Should have some of those.
Yeah.
New gear coming in at the end of this month, though. A lot of new gear.
Cool.
The store will be fully stocked. Glassware.
Right,
t-shirts, right. Everything.
Well, okay, so we say fully stocked, and here's the thing that happens.
Yeah.
People listen to this on a podcast later on, and they're like, well, you said it's fully stocked.
Right.
Yeah, it's fully stocked for like a week, all right? And then, you know, the word gets out that it's fully stocked, and then everybody buys up everything, and then it's no longer fully stocked. So you want to, you know, take it, you know, every couple of days, go to the store and check out what's there. Because, you know, the popular stuff, it gets in stock, and then, you know, there's only so much that can, you know, outlay that can, you know, buy this merchandise. So
yeah,
you know, there's limited quantity, so you want to get in there, get it quick. You know, don't delay and go, well, you know, I'm thinking about buying that shirt.
Well, you can make it easy on yourself and sign up on our Twitter, too. Twitter.com/brewingnetwork. I always send out an email when I put in, or a Twitter when we put in new stock. So then if you don't there feel you like go. Checking the store every day, just sign up. You'll get a notification the day it's in.
I never knew
that. And we've also gotten a little better because you guys have bought so much merch. Now we can stay in stock for about a month at a time. We can get enough stock for about a month at a time. So this time I predict it will be in there, but get in there. And that's what happens is I do get emails like you do for someone's listening to a show in 2007 and says, hey, you're talking about this store being fully stocked.
It's like the freaking, you know, the Brewing Classic Styles isn't in stock. Why, you know, I want to buy Brewing Classic Styles. It's like, well, you know.
That's on order too, by the way.
I don't know. So. All I do is forward these to Justin and go, hey.
Yeah. End of March.
Somebody wants this.
Fully stocked.
All right. So speaking of fully stocked. We got a fully stocked series of programs coming up for you here. All right. Now, we get all sorts of questions about the bottling beer, kegging beer, you know, priming rates, conditioning, when is my beer ready to package. You know, it seems one of the areas that a lot of people, you know, have a lot of questions on. They're confused. Yeah, you know, they're told like the basics of throw it in, you know, bottling bucket, some sugar, you know, it's always 3/4 cup or whatever, and put it in the bottles, and then it's, you know, it's right. And then they realize, you know, it's probably a little more complex than that. There's probably a few more equations I should be throwing on my priming sugar. You know, maybe it wasn't ready to bottle. You know, what kind of pressures do I use in my keg? Once I have, you know, carbonated beer in my keg, how do I bottle it? All these different things. So instead of just answering, you know, one of these questions today, I thought what we'd do is another Ganza show. And we're calling this one the Packagegasm.
Yeah.
Great.
Or bottling part one or packaging part one.
Oh, yeah, bottling part one sounds good. Yes. I like Packagegasm, but bottling part one would work also.
Yeah, we can't make a DVD of Packagegasm. That goes in a different shelf.
Yeah, there's probably some sort of warning that would be required for Packagegasm.
Yeah.
So we want to cover bottling and kegging. You know, in essence, packaging. We when we were discussing this series of programs, we were talking about packaging. And then I'm thinking, packaging beer. People are going to thinking shipping beer or whatever. And maybe we'll get into that by
true,
the time we reach this. I don't know. But really, bottling and kegging beer, putting your beer, once it's finished fermenting, into a container for serving and getting it carbonated properly. What are the steps in order to make that happen? And like other stuff, you may think, oh, I already know how to do this. But just stay tuned here. We got the Palmer as part of this show, and he'll make it, he'll open your eyes to a lot of the things you need to think about in order to really get the best results. And the best results, you know, can result in the best beer possible. So a lot of little things you want to think about from that aspect. Anything to add to that, Mr. Nice and Easy?
Well, no. There's a lot of, I mean, the problem with bottling is that it's just a pain in the butt. Most experienced home brewers move on to kegging at some point just because it's easier and we get lazy.
It's no longer nice and easy.
Yeah. But there are, I mean, Jamil and I can, you know, tell you some tips and tricks to make bottling easier, help you make sense of the process. Mm. And I've got my trusty cat Shadow here to fill in some of the blanks, you know, as you
walk off to admire your Blickman Engineering top tier system.
That's right. So, this show we're gonna you know, and address a lot of listener questions that we've received at BruceStrong.com. We're going to talk about...
Not BruceStrong.com. Somebody has scalped that URL and is holding it hostage until we pay thousands of dollars to get it. So it's
BruceStrong at TheBrewingNetwork.com.
Right.
But we do get a lot of questions on bottling and want to help address a lot of those. A lot of frequent questions are like, you know, how much of this sugar should I use? Mm-hmm. And a particularly interesting question came in that I liked, and I think we'll address later in the show, or maybe in another show to come, as we start working through this material. But the question was, hey, if I'm brewing a Belgian strong ale and the recipe has like 4 pounds of sucrose in it, should I use sucrose for priming, or is that, you know, too much white sugar?
All right.
And so, you know, it's a good question. We'll talk about that.
Okay. I'll tell you what, let's take a short break, and when we come back, let's get down and dirty with the package Ganza or Gasm. Back after this.
Brew right. Brew smart.
Brew strong.
This is Brew Strong.
From the stovetop to a camp burner to some kind of brew stand, most homebrewers follow some version of this progression. With each move, a homebrewer will often have to change a lot, if not all, of their equipment. Until now, Blickman Engineering brings you the Top Tier Brewing Stand, the only brewing stand that grows with you. For example, buy a top-tier floor-standing burner now, and it'll bolt right to your top-tier brewing stand when you're ready for all-grain brewing. The top-tier brewing stand is perfect for 5-gallon to 20-gallon batch sizes. Its modular design is adjustable and accommodates everything from small footprint coolers up to 30-gallon pots. How does the top-tier brewing stand do it? At its core is a strong, heat-treated, and anodized aluminum main post. On all four sides are built-in T-slots for the adjustable heavy-gauge stainless steel shelves and beefy burner tiers. The tiers accommodate any manufacturer's pots or coolers up to 21 inches in diameter. Best of all, not only does the top-tier brewing stand grow with your skills and equipment, but it easily knocks down for long-term storage or transport, too. The top-tier brewing stand from Blickman Engineering. Learn more at BlickmanEngineering.com and to find a local Blickman retailer. And start brewing from the top tier.
Downtown Joe's, located in the historic Oberon Building in beautiful downtown Napa, California, offers an award-winning brewpub experience from 8:30 a.m. to 1 a.m. every day. For 15 years at the corner of 2nd and Main, Downtown Joe's has been voted Best Night Spot 7 times and Best Brew Pub for the last 4 years in a row. Brewmaster Colin Kaminsky's handcrafted ales, like his Tail Wagon Amber Ale and Catherine the Great Imperial Stout, are the perfect accent to riverside dining, live music, and a relaxing outdoor patio. Don't miss the Beer of the Month, special rotating taps, and happy hour all day Mondays. Visit downtownjoes.com to make reservations, peruse their extensive calendar of events, or just read more about their fantastic beers. Come enjoy the fine beer, food, and music. Downtown Joe's, the award-winning brew pub where you'll feel at home.
Hi. My roommate's gone for the weekend, and I'm wearing something flimsy.
Listen, baby. I told her not to call me after 8. I gotta go.
Who is that? Your girlfriend?
Set up, Doug. Did you guys get the cauldron set up on the altar of my yard?
If you weren't so busy getting booty called, you know that.
All right, I'm using the scroll of Mosier to boil the first decoction.
You took too long. The color is now darkened past the point where you can still call it a pilsner.
This sucks. Ugh,
I hate it when Greg's the brewmaster.
What's this, Poindexter Urkel?
Dude, can't you see we're in the middle of a brew session?
Is that an actual beer?
Yeah, I crafted it. I don't really use the dice anymore. I'm a 10th level beer nerd.
Are you a 10th level beer nerd? Do you belch White Labs 833 and crap Simcoe? Then you're in good company at Northern Brewer. Check out Northern Brewer's huge selection of dorky beer kits, including the Cylon Detecting Three-Hearted Ale and the collector's item Super Alt.
Mine's in mint condition because it's still in the box.
Make 10th level at northernbrewer.com.
In the past year, the Brewing Network has been able to add 2 new shows, expand our studio capabilities and quality, and bring more beer information home to you than ever before.
In no small part, this is due to subscribers like you. Thank you from all of us at the Brewing Network. Without your monthly support of any denomination, we could not bring you the very best in live beer radio like Can You Brew It, Brew Strong, and the Sunday Session. Haven't signed up yet? Join your fellow brewers in the BN Army. Sign up today at thebrewingnetwork.com for a recurring donation as little as $2 a month. Besides all the great live radio you'll support, every subscriber is automatically entered in monthly raffles for amazing brew gear like a conical fermenter, a temperature control system, or your own draft setup. Become a part of the BN Army today.
Hilo, what's it feel like?
Take awesome and multiply it by two.
Yeah!
Spraying live beer radio all over your face.
Can't get any better than this, baby.
It's the Brewing Network.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer
into beer.
This is Brew Strong.
Beer.
That wasn't bad.
That was pretty good. We got to isolate that one. That was good. Didn't even sound like you.
Yeah. Well,
that was the good part of it. I don't know. No.
It's very manly.
I've got a Bullwinkle voice too, but I'm not sure how good it is.
Only one way to find out.
Go ahead.
Hello, poetry lovers.
Yeah, it's all right.
Okay. Yeah, let's get back.
Like beer.
Yeah, like your beer voice better.
That's you after a few beers. It's,
okay.
Yeah. All this and more. All Hackers. courtesy of BlickmanEngineering.com. All right. Yeah, we are talking about our package.
Yep.
We're talking about all right. So
how do you know when your beer is ready to package?
That's what I was going to say. How'd you know? That's what I was going to say. I've gone through fermentation and it looks like things are slowing down or have come to a stop. You know, I still see like a couple of bubbles every now and then. How do I know when it's time to package it up? Let's assume from this point I'm planning on putting in a bottle and adding sugar and letting it naturally carbonate. At what point do I say, okay, it's time to bottle? And at what point is it too late? When have I waited too long?
A year is too late.
okay.
But, you know, yeah, it's a really good question. And this is where experience comes in, and guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're we're talking about an ale fermentation, generally you're ready to bottle within a week, maybe 2 weeks. I like to wait 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I've waited 2 or 3 months because I'm lazy. Lagers, you want to wait longer. I mean, the fermentation itself, you want to be assured that fermentation is done before you bottle.
Right. Well, and I like you know, I think people want you know, specific signs. You know, why? Yeah. When is it done? And you know, what I like to say is, all right. You know, and for me, ales are like 10 days, and lagers are maybe 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's but you know, don't hold yourself to these time limits. Like you know, like the guys on Can You Brew It are being amazed because, you know, in 3 days, beer's done fermenting with some of these yeasts.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a very specific time. It depends on gravity, depends on the yeast, depends on temperature, it depends on so many factors that you can't just say, oh, you know, and this is the thing that, you know, annoys me.
Right.
I know the homebrew shops are trying to simplify it so people can get started.
Right.
But then, you know, people need to learn it isn't, you know, 7 days and then it's ready to go or whatever. Yeah. It's never a fixed amount.
You got to observe the activity.
Right. So
you've got to be involved in that brew.
I wait until all signs of activity have stopped, and then I give it another day, maybe two, and then I'm ready to package. And I think that's kind of along what you're saying. This is going to take, you know, a week or two for an ale. This is going to take, you know, 2 weeks or so for a lager. You know, if you're pitching the right amount of healthy yeast, you know. The only thing that worries me about my recommendation, see, this is where we get into difficulty, is these recommendations.
Right.
So waiting for all activity to stop, what if somebody's got like a wild yeast in there or, you know, bacteria or whatever, and they see the airlock very slowly chugging along, they see some sort of foam on the surface or maybe a pellicle forming, they think, well, it's still active. And what's happening is it'll go for a year like that.
Yeah.
Or 6 months or maybe a couple of months.
Yeah. You hit on one key point that the brewer needs to think about when they're looking at when is the beer ready to package, and is you start with clean, healthy yeast. You know, you've got to be confident that you've got a healthy fermentation going in. So that, you know, and that's where the guideline comes from, you know, with a good healthy fermentation,
right,
the beer is going to be done in 3 days to a week for an ale or 2 weeks for a lager.
Yep.
And so this, and, you know, if you're not real sure about the, you know, the health of the fermentation going in, you've got to observe that fermentation throughout its cycle. And, you know, and it helped, that's why it helps to have glass carboys as opposed to plastic buckets.
Mm-hmm.
If you're really confident in your process, you don't need to look at it. But if you're not real confident in your process, it helps to look at the beer, look at the activity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a fermenting batch, you know, there's all kinds of turnover. I mean, it looks like you're boiling the beer inside the fermenter because it's moving so much. You can see the yeast coming up and down and, you know, the airlock's going like crazy.
Right.
When that settles down and the airlock activity settles way down to like a bubble a minute, you know, kind of thing. I mean, you know, small activity and the beer's not moving anymore. Fermentation's pretty well over.
Well, and here's an interesting thing. It just happened to me. So in the yeast book that Chris White and I worked on, there's a, you know, it talks about top cropping yeast and how a lot of the yeast, while they may be top croppers, they won't stay on top of the beer. Once fermentation's complete, they'll drop down into the, you know, like other beers, other yeast, they'll all drop down into the beer and it doesn't stay up there forever. So one good signal of, you know, fermentation being done is the yeast have left the surface completely. The surface is still, there's nothing, no yeast left on the surface. They've all dropped down to the bottom. You know, good sign fermentation is complete.
Now, there'll still be bubbles around the edges.
Right.
You'll get some bubbles around the edges. You'll still have a like, little slimy appearance and, you know, some foam kind of off the side, but it's not moving.
Well, and here's where it gets interesting. So I had to acquire a yeast from Y-Yeast to do this clone of Black Sheep beer. And Black Sheep uses these Yorkshire Square. They actually use a round version of a Yorkshire Square, you know, modernized version to brew it. And they have this yeast, and, of course, it's a serious top cropper. Well, I've never used this yeast before. I ferment this batch of beer, and first off, it's squirted out, you know, a good pound of yeast solids at the top, out of a better bottle, the little dry lock of the better bottle. I got a pound of yeast through that little tiny little hole. I got a pound of yeast sitting on the ground, and like no moisture, just a pound of yeast, and in a big ball. And then so after this beer's done fermenting, I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, oh boy, there's still a bunch of yeast on the surface. I'm taking a look, and I'm like, you know, and usually I just like, oh, you know, if you don't see any yeast, things done. Yeast was sitting on the surface, and the thing done fermenting like a week ago. And it was still sitting on the surface. There was still yeast sitting on the surface like a week after fermentation was done across the entire surface. I was like, no way.
Yeast,
I'm like, no, there's some sort of problem here. It's not, you know, It must still be fermenting, or there must still be CO2 evolving to hold the yeast up at the surface. Because what happens is the yeast flocculate together. They stick together, form kind of these mats or these larger chunks. And then the CO2 that's coming out in the beer, it lifts them to the surface, and they rise up to the surface and to the top. Well, for some reason, this yeast was still on the surface well after fermentation. So that's a very rare case. Unless you're using only a few select yeast, I don't think you'll ever see that happen. So usually if the yeast have dropped to the bottom, you don't see any airlock activity, it's been about the right amount of time, you can take a hydrometer reading and things seem to have attenuated fully, then fermentation's done.
Right. Yeah, it's like we said, experience. You know, you need to know your yeast, look for the usual signs, and then interpret them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think you and I, we both tend to eschew secondary fermentation or transferring to another vessel for further fermentation unless we're doing something special like dry hopping or fruit or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I'm a perpetuator of the myth at howtobrew.com.
Perpetuator.
Yeah. Good word. At howtobrew.com, the first version of the book, you know, first edition, still talks about the benefits, or kind of, you know, promotes the benefits of transferring the beer off the yeast.
Well, and that was the you know, the popular way of doing things.
Yeah.
Well, and that's why, you know, you're on third edition, fourth edition now?
Third, yeah, still on third, but...
You know, third edition, people, you know, stop getting the free thing off the internet, which is fine, but buy yourself a frickin' third edition copy with, you know, all of John's latest and you know, use that, for God's sake.
Yeah, you'll get the updated information, yeah. Yep. Train left.
with all the cretins on it.
Yeah. Now I was going to say
secondary. We're talking secondary. And
yes, thank you.
And the transfer myth.
Yeah, transfer myth. Yeah, as we've gotten more educated on how much, you know, good healthy yeast you need for an optimum fermentation, the advice that we used to give 10 years ago has changed. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, homebrewers were brewing with a single packet of dry yeast that was taped to the top of the can. Or, you know, there weren't as many liquid yeast cultures available. And
people didn't make starters either.
Yeah, people didn't make starters. So, you know, the whole health and vitality of yeast was different then as it is to now. Yep. So back then it made sense. You know, you've got weaker yeast in, you know, that have finished a fermentation that were more susceptible to autolysis and breaking down. Now that is not the case, and really it's not. Where homebrewer the bar on homebrewing has risen to where we are able to make beer that has the same robustness as professional beer.
Right.
I mean, we've gotten our techniques and our understanding of what makes a good fermentation up to that level. So, well, you don't need to transfer the beer off the yeast to prevent autolysis like we used to recommend.
Unless you're going to do long term at warm temperatures, and you know even then we're talking, you know, over a month. I thought about this as well, and I think one of the reasons, you know, autolysis, as you mentioned, also the fact that a lot of times, you know, people were using weak yeast in inappropriate amounts, and the transfer would add some oxygen to it and would help attenuate a few more points, and I think that was part of the deal why secondary transfer to another vessel was considered an appropriate act back years ago.
Yeah.
So.
But, you know, these days we don't recommend secondary transfer. Leave it in the primary, a month. You know, I mean, Today's fermentations are typically healthy enough that you're not going to get autolysis flavors or off flavors due to leaving the yeast, leaving the beer on the yeast for an extended period of time.
Well, if you're starting with healthy yeast in an appropriate amount, and you know the thing is, you know, homebrew style fermenters, if you're using a carboy plastic bucket, you know, something like that, it's got that broad, shallow, or that broad cross-section base. Yeah. When the yeast flocculate out, they lay in a nice thin layer. And, you know, when you're dealing in large, tall, one of these things, you know, people go, well, you know, the commercial brewers, they remove the yeast because, you know, it's going to break down, it's going to die, it's going to make the beer bad. You know, we should be doing the same thing. You know, that's where a lot of this comes from as well. Well, you know, the commercial brewers are working with, you know, 100-barrel fermenters that are very tall, put a lot of pressure on the yeast. The yeast are jammed down into this little cone in the bottom, and they're stacked very deep and generate
static pressure.
And the yeast also, there's a lot of heat buildup. The core of that heat mass, that yeast mass, can be, you know, several degrees C higher than the rest of the yeast mass, and it can cook the yeast. It actually cook the yeast, cause them to die faster, and cause those problems with flavor. And within a couple of days, also the viability of that yeast, which those commercial brewers will reuse, it's going to drop just, you know, 25%, 50% over just a couple of days. So they need to get that yeast out of there. You don't have that restriction as a home brewer. You've got these broad, shallow fermenters, or, you know, broad fermenter bases that allow the yeast to be distributed evenly. You know, it's an advantage for cleaning up the beer. It's an advantage in that the yeast don't break down as fast. You don't have as high a head pressure on that thing. You don't have all this other hydrostatic pressure. It's, you know, there's a lot of advantages. We're kind of getting off the track here, but it's important, I think, to cover this to understand why, you know, you want to wait for the beer to finish fermenting before you do something and take action.
Right. A question is, you know, what is green beer? You know, well, green beer is beer that's, you know, really not done fermenting. I mean, in previous shows, Jamil, we talked about, you know, what is the fermentation process? You know, you got the lag phase, you've got the the logarithmic phase, and then you got a conditioning phase.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of fermentation, well, all, you know, really kind of all through, but more so towards the end, the yeast are reabsorbing diacetyl, acetaldehyde. Mm-hmm. They're esterifying some fusel alcohols to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the yeasts clean up the beer towards the end of fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you drank a beer, homebrew that's full of yeast, you know, it doesn't taste the same as, a homebrew without a lot of yeast suspended in it.
Right.
You know, so all of these factors are, you know, are things you want to avoid, mm-hmm. you know, when it comes to bottling. I mean, typically when I used to bottle a lot, I would leave the beer in the primary fermenter until I saw that beer start to clear. And, you know, fermentation's been done. It is now, you know, 3 weeks after I pitched the yeast and it's, you know, done. The yeast cake from the top has fallen back in. There was no yeast cake on top, but the beer was still, you know, cloudy with suspended yeast. And after a while, I would see that beer darken as the yeast settled out.
Mm-hmm.
The beer, you know, the color of the beer would seem to darken because you don't have the white yeast suspended in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I would tend to transfer to my bottling bucket and prime
mm-hmm.
and bottle. And I would end up with a very thin yeast layer on the bottom of my bottles, which made, you know, actually serving the beer a lot easier.
Right.
And it also gave time for all those conditioning processes to finish.
Right. Because if you can see yeast in your beer, then it's way more yeast than you need to for bottling. So during our previous show, we were talking about just briefly about yeast densities and estimating yeast densities. If you can see yeast, if the difference between, you know, pure water with no yeast in it, and when you can just see that there's something suspended in the water where it just starts to seem like it's slightly turbid, that's a million cells per milliliter, which is the appropriate amount for bottling amount of yeast. Like Sierra Nevada, they filter their yeast out. That's what the amount of yeast they add back. Well, and I think you bring up another excellent point, which is the green beer. You know, one of the nice things about these broad fermenters that we use for homebrew, these buckets and carboys, is that you know, that nice broad surface of yeast actually is still active, still absorbing you know, these compounds and active. The yeast in suspension are, but that yeast surface on the bottom actually does take a role in it.
Mm-hmm.
And people go, no, it's completely dormant. It's not doing anything. I really don't think that's true. You know, one of the reasons that Anheuser-Busch uses the beechwood chips is that, you know, the very fine fibers that are sticking up in the rough surface of the wood chips that are in there is surface area for yeast. So the yeast settle out onto these things, and it helps condition the beer. It helps actually make for a cleaner, you know, better tasting lager. That's why they do it. It's not for oak flavor or for beech flavor in the beer.
Yeah,
it is for the yeast to have surface area to provide a super massive yeast surface area that is, you know, absorbing these compounds or, you know, reducing these compounds into less flavor active compounds, you know, or more flavor friendly compounds. So the same thing kind of happens in a homebrew fermenter with that broad surface of yeast. So, you know, don't freak out about that. It actually, you know, and that's why I give it a day or two after I see all of fermentation activity has ended. Ah, okay, let me give it a day or two to finish really, you know, reducing these compounds. Then the beer's ready to package.
Yeah. There's, and you can bottle, you know, right after that, after, you know, the yeast cake has kind of settled out and the beer may still be turbid with yeast. You can bottle then, but it certainly doesn't hurt to wait till the weekend, you know, and let more of that yeast mass settle out of the beer.
So it starts to look clearer.
Yeah.
You see that color change. And, you know, if you're really timid and figure that, you know, there's not enough yeast, you could always siphon a little bit of yeast off the bottom,
right,
to mix back in. If it's been a real long time, that's probably a good idea, right, John?
I've
waited a month. I was out of town. I couldn't get it done. I had a baby. You know, friend came in from out of town. I ran out of gas and had a flat tire. You know, go ahead and siphon a little bit of yeast off the bottom. So, all right. So I think we covered fairly well, you know, what point the beer is ready to transfer and to be, you know, packaged. And we're going to take our time on this. I mean, we've got open-ended number of shows to get this done. I want to make sure we're really covering this topic fully so we know what we're doing here. So people have all their questions answered because we get so many questions on this, like water.
Yeah.
Water took 5 shows, and I still don't think we should have done 10.
Yeah.
So the package gasm is going to take us however many shows required. All right. So
transfer.
Well, yeah, transfer. So the beer's done. Now we need to transfer this to, because our first thing we're talking about is bottling bucket. We're talking bottling.
Typically with bottling bucket.
Bottling with priming sugar for natural carbonation. That's the first thing we're going to cover. Because otherwise, it's transfer to keg is a little different. All right, so I need to transfer the beer. How do I do this? I want to make this a smooth process. I don't want to contaminate. My biggest fear always is I don't want to contaminate the beer. I don't want to oxidize the beer. I don't want to you know, somehow mess up the beer. That's, you know, how do I do this without messing up and making it easy on myself and not having a big headache of the whole thing?
Yeah. Well, those are two really big issues when it comes to bottling is oxygen contamination and bacterial contamination. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to transfer the beer, you know, to the bottle, your siphon has to be clean, has to be sanitized.
Mm-hmm.
And I make it a practice to buy a new auto siphon every year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for those of you that don't know the difference between a regular racking cane and hose and an auto siphon, you don't have to suck on auto siphons. It's a little pump dealy. There's a little valve in the bottom, and you just stick it down in the beer, raise the inner tube, and push it back down, and that siphon goes. It's one of the greatest inventions ever.
So you raise and push, and then you don't have to suck.
That's right. Yeah, and as Sven knows, you don't want to suck. The auto siphon makes the whole siphoning process a lot easier because you don't have to worry about contaminating to get that siphon started. Other ways to start a siphon are to, you know, fill it with sanitized water, sanitized solution, and let that drain out into another container as it pulls the beer through, and then you transfer that to your bottling bucket. But that's where you run into the oxygen problem. Mm-hmm. You know, putting a fast siphoning beer into the bottom, the wide bottom of bottling bucket, lots of oxygen exposure. For a beginning home brewer, where you don't have a handy CO2 tank to purge that bucket beforehand, the best you can do is to tip that bucket a little on its edge, and get some depth to that beer as fast as you can, and submerge the end of the hose into the filling beer. And you should have put your priming solution into the bucket ahead of time. In this way, you reduce the turbulence, you reduce the surface area of the beer that you're, exposing to the air, and you reduce the oxygen pickup at this point, because as Charlie Bamforth told us in the oxidation shows and so on, the shelf life of the beer is really dependent on oxygen exposure of packaging. Mm-hmm. You can do everything up ahead of that, but as good a job as you can do in the brewing process itself, the big variable for shelf life is oxygen exposure of packaging.
I agree with you in all that you've said.
Okay.
But I wouldn't want people to get so panicked about oxygen that they forget that the more important thing is exposure to contamination, bacteria, wild yeast, for long-term storage. And I would think,
true,
flavor-wise, that's the bigger problem, because so many people are used to drinking oxidized beer that most people don't notice it. Even, BJCP judges don't, they expect oxidized beer. So, if I had to, my druthers, ideally you want to avoid both, but don't avoid oxygen with the at an expense of, bacterial or any other non-desired yeast contamination.
Okay. Yeah. That's a real good point. I mean, that's another thing BJCP judges get during competitions is foaming bottles. They crack the top and all of a sudden you got a gusher due to wild yeast. So the bacterial cleanliness of your siphon and your bottling bucket and the little valve on the bottling bucket that you use to fill from, these are critical.
Yep.
Clean bottles. We've talked about in bottling for competition. Mm-hmm. Buy brand new clean bottles. Mm-hmm. Don't, reuse some bottle that you've had sitting in the garage for a year.
Yeah.
Reduce the risk of bacterial contamination.
And, I'm a big recycling guy, and the ultimate recycling is reusing a container. Not to just, turn in for recycling, but reuse it as many times as you can. And, glass being, fairly strong, and as long as you don't heat cycle it too many times, it's fine. But boy, you really need to be very, very careful how you clean that. You need to make sure that, you're using the PBW and you thoroughly clean those things to be spotless. before you package your beer in it, because you'll end up with use a good sanitizer. Just throwing them in the oven at 250 for a couple hours does not sterilize the bottle. It takes a higher heat and a longer time in order to do that, and that's just you're throwing away beer. If you don't do that,
yeah. And more to the point, your plastics, the vinyl hoses that you use on siphons, the vinyl hose that you may use off the bottling bucket. Mm-hmm. These
every year,
yeah,
replace twice them. A year, every so many batches. Just buy a big spool, get it in bulk. It's cheap.
Yep.
Ask your homebrew shop to sell you a spool for cheap. Buy it. Give you a discount on a spool size order, and snap yourself off a nice fresh piece every few. You like, Justin likes snap yourself off.
A nice fresh piece. I like that.
For a nice fresh piece. I live my life by those words. That's my motto. Snap yourself off a nice fresh piece.
I'm gonna change that to my motto too, if you don't mind. I like it.
It's so, I think we need shirts.
It's a way to live.
Snap yourself off a nice fresh piece. Brew strong.
Yeah. It's pretty good.
That's going to be a good seller.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a short break, and let's get right back into transferring after we're done. Back after these few brief words.
Do you support the Brewing Network? Do you brew your own? Are you looking for an economical, fun, and legal way to do both? Subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine and do just that. All year long, Brew Your Own will surprise you, entertain you, and educate you with articles on beer and brewing from authors like the Brewing Network's very own Jamel Zalishev and John Palmer. Each issue is a full pint of brewing techniques, homebrew stories, tips and photos, projects to make yourself, and recipes for the avid home brewer. Get your tough questions answered by Mr. Wizard, and polish your style accuracy with Jamel. A portion of every subscription goes to the Brewing Network, so subscribe today at byo.com/brewingnetwork or just click the BYO logo on the Brewing Network homepage and support a fantastic hobby and your favorite broadcaster. Brew Your Own, the how-to homebrew beer magazine.
Hey, what are you doing, man?
Writing a review of WLP 400.
What? You're reviewing yeast?
Yeah. White Labs has home brewer reviews of all their strains. Are you new to these interwebs? Check it out.
That's awesome.
White Labs, your source for great yeast, invites all brewers to visit whitelabs.com to read and write your own reviews of all their yeast strains. Get real-world tips and tricks from other brewers who have made the most of their vials and post your own experiences. It's another way White Labs brings you closer to the best yeast on the planet.
And send. There you go. You misspelled flocculate, dude.
What?
White Labs. It's all in the vial.
Hi, this is Push from the Brewing Network, and I want to tell you about the Brewmaster's Warehouse and how you can get 10% off your next order. I'm a pretty techie guy, but I've never seen an online store like this. It's awesome. Go to brewmasterswarehouse.com and click on Brew Builder. You can whip up a custom recipe so easily even Sven could do it. Seriously, it's slick. You can share your recipe with your own logo and notes to the Brewmaster's database if you want. And the best part, it keeps a running tally of the beer you're building while you're doing it. Then, bam, click Buy Recipe and your cart is filled and ready to go with helpful suggestions in case you forgot something. This thing is amazing. Brewmaster's Warehouse is run the way a home brewer would do it, with great service, fast turnaround, and $6.99 flat rate shipping. Brewmaster's Warehouse and the Brew Builder blew me away. Check it out today at brewmasterswarehouse.com. I'm serious. And don't forget to put BNARMY in the discount code box for 10% off your order. Check out brewmasterswarehouse.com. Cheers.
BN Army members, are you looking for a discount on hops? Keep listening. Nico's Homebrew Supply at NicoBrew.com has hops by the ounce and by the pound. Choose from varieties like Amarillo, Centennial, East Kent Goldings, Holler Tower, Simcoe, Summit, Tomahawk,
Warrior, Willamette, and more. And adding new varieties all the time, many for less than $20 a pound. Whether a couple ounces at a time or an 11-pound bag, all hops are shipped vacuum-sealed and frozen straight to you. Nico's Homebrew Supply offers store-wide $5 flat-rate shipping and won't waste your money on unnecessary overhead or advertising. They're going bare bones and passing the savings on to you. The staff at Nico's Homebrew Supply loves to brew and is committed to keeping homebrewing affordable and accessible to anyone who wants to join in this great hobby. And for a limited time, use coupon code BNARMY at checkout for a Brewing Network discount. Visit NicoBrew.com. That's NikoBrew.com for your hops and more. NicoBrew.com, your bare bones buddy in the brewing business.
Hey, Push, the new brewery's looking good.
Thanks, Finn. Piece by piece.
Well, let's fire her up. Whoa! Is that a new kettle?
Yeah, just got it brand new, but paid half price.
What? And that blade scale?
40% off.
The new tap handle?
$5 instead of 13. Got a new regulator for the brew stand, too, but $5 instead of 25.
Dude, where are you stealing all this stuff from?
Where else? The more beer deal of the day.
Announcing the Beer, Beer, and More Beer Deal of the Day. Every day, a new fantastic deal from big items to small that will blow you away. Boil kettles, carboy carriers, sterile siphon starters, digital timers. Watch morebeer.com every day for a new deal, and you just might find the item you've been waiting for at a price you cannot believe. Hurry, because stock is limited on most items.
And that sweet Guinness cap, let me guess.
The More Beer Deal of the Day.
Yeah, I knew it. Come on, let's brew something.
Find the More Beer Deal of the Day at morebeer.com. Celebrity voices impersonated.
You're listening to the Brewing Network.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
All right, we're back. We're enjoying our packagegasm. And all right, so we're transferring beer to the bucket, and you're saying tip the bucket on edge, so the bottling bucket, so you are getting depth quickly. And did you say flush the headspace with some CO2?
Yeah, I mean if you've got CO2, it helps to flush the headspace. I mean,
okay.
Anything you can do to minimize oxidation or oxygen exposure at packaging, mm-hmm. will prolong the shelf life of the beer.
Right. Well, you know, and if your beer's at, you know, any reasonable temperature, you know, when you transfer it, some CO2 is in solution and it's a little bit super saturated, and it will come out of solution and
right.
maybe provide a little bit of protection, but. I guess, yeah, if you could, you know, squirt a little CO2 into there, you know, one of those little bike CO2 tire inflators, you know,
yeah.
A little bit, definitely.
Yeah, it's a nice to have. It's not a have to have.
Because mm-hmm. The yeast will take up some of that that oxygen, won't they?
Yeah, they will. They take up a portion of it, and you know, for the priming. Carbonation fermentation aspect, you know, they will take up some of the yeast, I mean, some of the oxygen that in the headspace of the bottle,
mm-hmm.
and oxygen that is exposed to during the transfer to the bottling bucket.
Mm-hmm.
But as you're saying, Jamil, I mean, you know, bacterial contamination is a much more serious threat than worrying about long-term, you know, staling of the beer.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to, you know, lay out, you know, all the recommendations that we would have mm-hmm. when you're bottling.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, cleanliness is really the first priority. Oxygen exposure is a secondary priority.
Mm-hmm. So cleanliness is next to godliness, and oxygen exposure is next to
something. Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody fill in the blank. All right, now one more question. All right, so we're going to transfer this bucket, and we've calculated out our priming sugar for the bucket.
How did you do that?
I don't know. how do we do that? I mean, how much sugar do I need? Does it? It depends on so many things, right? Because you need to take into account how much CO2 is already in the beer, and different temperatures, different. I don't know. Different altitudes probably has an effect.
That's right.
You know, makes some difference on. On the CO2 content of the beer, existing CO2 content, and then we're trying to build more CO2 content. But you have to take that existing part into account, right?
Yeah, you do. I mean, if you want to get really technical about carbonation level, you know, you're entering this beer at Nationals, and you're looking for a ribbon with a bottle conditioned beer. You'd want to be really technical and try to calculate the amount of carbonation in the bottle as best you can, and that's going to depend on the atmospheric pressure that the beer is at when you bottle it, the temperature of the beer. All this can affect the amount of dissolved carbon dioxide in the beer at the time of bottling, and then you would adjust the amount of priming sugar you add to that level to get your target carbonation in the bottle.
Mm-hmm. I would think that's
going pretty far,
right? I would think. Let me interrupt you here.
Sure.
I would think that there's a lot of environmental factors, but most of those are a constant. Like your altitude, atmospheric pressure, things like that are fairly consistent. Barometric pressure is changing, but the things you really want to focus on are the temperature of the beer and the style of the beer, number of volumes you want to get to. Those two things are probably your real focus, right?
Right, right. Yeah. So, to take a step back, look at a little bigger picture. There are priming sugar calculators such as in How to Brew or Brewing Classic Styles, elsewhere out on the web, beer tools and ProMash and so on, that are designed to help you calculate how much priming sugar to add. Typically, this is corn sugar. Different sugars contribute different amounts of carbonation, on a weight basis. And I don't know, maybe if everybody were to turn to page 111 in their How to Brew books, there's a chart there that shows the contributions from different kinds of sugar. And you can prime with any fermentable sugar. The thing to realize is there's two factors and determine how much carbonation you get from any one sugar. One is the percent of moisture in the sugar, and the other is the degree of fermentability of that sugar. So, for instance, everybody typically primes with corn sugar in the United States. It's totally glucose. It's a very simple sugar, and the typical recommendation is 3/4 cup. Well, if you weigh that out accurately and average it over several weighings, that's usually about 4 ounces by weight, or 115 grams of corn sugar for a typical 5-gallon batch, looking for a typical 2 volumes of CO2, I think. And corn sugar is 8% moisture, or 92% sugar, 8% water. And so you get about, if you compare that to cane sugar, which doesn't absorb water, you need more corn sugar than you do cane sugar to get the same amount of carbonation out of it. You with me so far, Jamil?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. The cane sugar doesn't absorb water, and you need roughly 3.7 ounces or 104 grams of cane sugar for 5 gallons versus the 4 ounces or 114 grams of corn sugar.
All right, so I'm with you, but let me interrupt here. So the reason why measuring by weight versus volume then is, if I'm following you, is that when you're measuring by weight, cane sugar doesn't absorb a lot of water. So weight is pretty consistent.
Yeah, or cane volume is consistent with it's more consistent with
by weight.
Yeah,
since it doesn't absorb water, whereas volume is less consistent because
packing
these are crystals. If you look at them under a microscope, they're like little cubes or whatever, right? And if you tap a container, vibrate a container of sugar, you'll see the level will just drop. I mean, if you loosely pour some sugar into a cup, it'll fill it up, and then you put on a shaker, it'll just drop, and you'll see a substantial drop in the volume of sugar you have there.
Right.
It makes volume very inaccurate because the little cubes line up, and then all of a sudden they take up less space. And you have a huge difference in the amount of sugar. That's why a scoop of sugar in your 3/4 cup is not that accurate. And that's why you are better off by weight. When you're doing other sugars, humidity may play a bigger role. Mm-hmm. But I guess you're saying, I didn't know this about cane sugar, but it doesn't absorb a whole lot of moisture.
Right.
So that would make weight much more accurate.
Right. That's the key is if you weigh by weight, you've got to be aware that of how much water typically is in the sugar. Mm-hmm. 8% for corn sugar, but it can absorb more.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're trying to prime with corn sugar that is in clumps, and is not in a free flowing powder,
mm-hmm.
well, there's a lot more moisture tied up in that. In that sugar,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to get less carbonation out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So
the sugar used for priming, we should get it on a dry day.
It helps,
and store it in a sealed container and not leave it open often.
If you're trying to be super accurate on your mm-hmm. carbonation levels, then yes.
Right. It doesn't hurt to take those precautions, would it? I mean, it's pretty easy to do. A sealed container. Don't leave it open in the bag.
Right.
And then, when doing this yeast book, it's not something I knew, but Chris White, he pulled a lot of research for this book, and he gave me a piece of research on the flavors of priming sugars and the differences that they made in the beer. And the essential recommendation was just always use cane sugar, I think.
Oh.
And I was like, okay.
Yeah. It's certainly cane sugar is a lot more readily available than corn sugar.
And very consistent. If you're getting, you can use DME or something like that. The problem is, I think you can get different sources and you can end up with different results.
Mm-hmm. That's right. There's in Table 13 and How to Brew, there's a comparison of corn sugar, cane sugar, brown sugar, candy sugar, Lyle's golden syrup, maple syrup, honey,
mm-hmm.
Dry malt extract. So if you, as the brewer, are trying to get a certain level of carbonation, this table will help you equate roughly how much sugar to use compared to the standard recommendation of 4 ounces or 3/4 cup of corn sugar.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have a nomograph or something that'll help me determine? Because we need to determine how much CO2 is in the beer and how much CO2 I need to potentially add.
Mm-hmm.
And how do I do that?
Yeah. Well, I got a nomograph on page 113, and it's also available at howtobrew.com. And like I said, various beer software has this built in into a, more user-friendly computer interface rather than a nomograph.
Mm-hmm.
But what you do is
Nomograph's pretty easy, though.
You
hold a ruler or a straight edge.
Mm-hmm. draw a line from the temperature of the beer.
You don't even need to draw a line. You just hold it.
Line it up. Yeah.
Line it up and read the number.
Yeah. But the way the nomograph works is you lay out a line from the temperature of the beer through the desired volumes of CO2 that you want in the beer.
Which you can get from like brewing classic styles.
Yep.
For pretty much every beer style.
Yep. Typically 1.5 to 2.5 volumes of CO2 for most beers.
Mm-hmm.
British, 1.5 to 2. German or American, 2 to 2.5, depending on style.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll read off, the nomograph will give you the weight of corn sugar or cane sugar that you need to provide that much carbonation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the nomograph is set up for 5 gallons. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to make 6 gallons, if you're carbonating 6 gallons of beer, mm-hmm. you've got to add 6/5 more mm-hmm. to the amount you read off the nomograph. I mean, it does scale linearly.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you do need to ratio it, but that's how it works.
Okay. Very cool. Okay. All right, so we've added the priming sugar, and then we're running out of time here on this subject. Do we want to cover whether we should add yeast or not, or should we end it here and
let's touch on yeast.
All right.
Yeah, we won't. We'll save forced carbonating and bottling from a keg. For
yeah, we got
show.
As many shows as we need to get this done.
Yeah. But when it comes to bottle carbonating or bottle conditioning, a frequent question is, the beer's been sitting, in the fermenter for a month or 2 months. I had it without a town. I couldn't get to it. And, it looks like the yeast is all settled out.
Mm-hmm.
Do I need to add more yeast? Well, it depends. But Even in a clear-looking beer, in a clear-looking homebrew, there is still a lot of yeast in suspension unless that beer has been sitting at, near 32 for a couple of months. That will force more yeast out of suspension.
Mm-hmm.
And for people that are doing lagers and have been through a long lagering period, it really does help to add yeast to the priming solution during bottling.
Mm-hmm.
And it also helps for ales if it's been sitting on, it's been settling for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Adding more yeast doesn't help. The amount of yeast you need to add is not that much. It's you can either suck it up from the bottom of the fermenter as you're transferring, mm-hmm. Or you can add a fresh smack pack or a fresh tube. You really only need, that tube's worth of yeast, or
the fifth of that, right? So
yeah.
You need 1 million cells per milliliter in 20 liters of beer. You'd only need a fifth of a smack pack or a vial or one of those propagator yeast propagator packs. It's even too much there because you're between 30 and 50 billion, but a billion cells per liter. So, for dry yeast, you need a couple of grams or gram or to a couple of grams, depending on the yeast, will provide enough. The thing, I get asked this question a lot, and, the thing that I find to be important is, people say, well, I've got a really high gravity brew. I listened to the Can You Brew at Dogfish 120 show, and yeah. I want to naturally carbonate this. I'm like, well, me, I'm lazy. I put it in a keg. I force carbonate it, and there you go. But do I need to add more yeast? Yes. Chances are, once you get up into the 20-some-odd% range of alcohol by volume, it's really just destroyed the yeast. It's gassed them there. It's toxic to the yeast. So you're going to want to do a fresh pitch of yeast and along with your priming sugar and go there.
Yep, very true. Very true. Yeah, the yeast are – at that strong a beer, the yeast are full. They're not interested in fermenting anymore.
Right. And just the stress of trying to keep the alcohol outside the cell
Yeah.
So it doesn't become kill the yeast cells themselves is, you know, very taxing on the yeast. So that's that's one of the things you need to watch out for as well. So, you know, that, and then I also get people go, you know, sour beers, you know, they're like, well, it's been 6 months and I want to bottle this. Should I add more yeast? Yeah, you definitely should. You know, and generally you need priming sugar and yeast, and you know you want a nice active yeast. So, you know, one thing you can do is make a small starter wort, just a real simple wort, or even what I imagine. You generally we advise against using simple sugars for propagating yeast because they become unable to ferment maltose very quickly. Right. You know, if you grow them in simple sugars, they lose the enzyme that will ferment maltose. But if you were to want to add yeast for priming, what do you think of this? It'd be difficult to calculate the sugar, but, you know, get your yeast and get them active using just table sugar.
Right.
Right, in like a pint of liquid or even less with table sugar and just enough yeast, you know, a million cells per milliliter or a billion per liter for your batch of beer. Add some simple sugars to like a specific gravity of, you know, 1030, 1040. And when the yeast start going crazy, dump that whole thing in. You probably need... You want to get it before they really started creating a lot of CO2, because that's what you really want.
Right. You're looking to carbonate.
But dump that whole thing in, maybe with a little bit extra sugar, and then bottle it up. I bet you'd get great carbonation.
It would
be real fast. And
and you'd avoid the yeast really acting on the residual sugars you have in the beer.
Right. And and they'd be sucking up any oxygen. They'd be nice and active and scouring oxygen as rapidly as they could. That might be something interesting to test out.
Sounds like a great idea.
All right. Are we at a point we can wrap before we get to the Packagegasm 2?
I think so. Any questions from the chat room? Or?
We got a bunch. All right. Let's take a short break. When we come back, I'll have a beer. You'll have questions. And we'll all enjoy doing what we do. Back after this.
When Blickman Engineering set out to design a great brewing stand, they knew it had to be strong, adaptable, and last for a lifetime. The top-tier brewing stand is now proudly available at BlickmanEngineering.com. It grows with your brewing skills and equipment. Start with 5-gallon coolers on its heavy-gauge stainless steel shelves. Then move all the way up to 30-gallon pots on the high-output burner tiers. Speaking of burners, the custom Blickman Engineering top-tier burners are extremely powerful, efficient, and amazingly quiet. They have safety stops to center your pot, and they'll last a lifetime and won't rust. The top-tier brewing stand allows virtually infinite combinations from traditional gravity systems to two tiers to completely horizontal. Configure your stand the way you want and have the freedom to change it at any time in the future. Your brewing stand should adapt with you, not force you to learn a new process. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com today to configure your top-tier brewing stand and to find a local Blickman retailer. You'll be surprised with all the flexible features and the competitive price. Start brewing with Blickman from the top tier.
Nico, listen, our lawyers said that we had to do this for 1 hour, and after this, we don't have to talk to each other for 3 more months until the next meeting.
Kids. Come on, let's get out of here.
I'm supposed to have more lines. I'm the professional. Hey, it's Sully.
And I'm Nico.
And we opened the 21st Amendment 10 years ago at 563 2nd Street in San Francisco, just 2 blocks from Giants Park, to make great beer and have a great time doing it.
That's right, because to us, the 21st Amendment is more than just the right to make beer. It's the right to experiment, to be innovative, and just do things differently. And so now, we're putting our craft beer in cans.
That's right, cans. You can find our world-famous Heller High Watermelon Wheat Beer at Brew Free or Die IPA in the Northeast, Northwest, parts of the Midwest, and Alaska in cans and on draft. So next time you're at your local neighborhood pub or good beer store, be sure to ask for 21st Amendment in cans.
Because everyone likes it in the can.
Tasty Crack Cans.
Tasty Crack Cans.
Williams Brewing is your online resource for prompt delivery of quality home brewing supplies. Since 1979, Williams Brewing has offered the finest equipment and freshest ingredients and the best customer service in the business. Cut hours off your brewing sessions by using one of our 11 varieties of famous Williams malt extract. Our Williams Belgian Pale Extract is mashed with pure Belgian two-row malt and a small percentage of Belgian wheat malt for an authentic Belgian character you just can't get from other extracts. Or check out our unique fermenters, 2.5-gallon kegs, paintball tank-based draft beer equipment, bottling aids, and much more. We even have our own line of precision hydrometers. Go to WilliamsBrewing.com to browse our vast selection. That's WilliamsBrewing.com. Orders placed by 3:30 p.m. Pacific time ship the same day. Brewing is easy. The Williams way.
Hey, BNers, Brewcaster Jay here. Are you tired of hearing about great beer here in the Brewing Network that you can't get at your local bottle shop? Well, we do interviews from all over the world, and we want to taste those beers too. Finally, there's a place to turn for great beers from the other coast and beyond. Brewforia.com. Brewforia has an incredible selection of amazing beer, and they're adding more all the time. From breweries big and small, craft beer, imported beer, organic, and even gluten-free. You're going to love all the choices. When the brewcasters can't find an upcoming guest beer, we turn to Brewforia, and you should too. Just check the Brewing Network for the upcoming guest schedule and head to Brewforia.com for their beer. The great guys at Brewforia will even include free beer for you with qualifying orders. Free beer, BN Army. You know we like that. Visit our favorite online bottle shop today at BrewForia.com. That's Brewforia.com. Brewforia. When you can't get it, they can.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking Packagegasm. How to bottle and how to keg your beer. And, you know, there's just so much a little detail to cover that I think, you know, this is going to require multiple shows. So we're cutting it off here, and we'll pick back up in the in a subsequent show about, you know, priming rates and adding yeast and getting into the bottle and, you know.
Doing it with a bottle part two.
Doing it with a bottle part two. And, you know, tips and techniques I think people want to hear from you, Northeast, on how you, you know, make it easy.
Yep. Okay.
He's wondering about the Northeast. Oh, N-E. Yeah. Oh, I get it. All right. But right now we got some questions in the chat room specifically about this topic. But if you're listening, you know, you can jump right in to the chat room. You go over to thebrewnetwork.com. There's a chat now button. You know, click on that. It'll get you in. There's no password required or anything. It'll say password, but you don't need that. Just type in any name you want. You can be anonymous. Just type in gobbledygook. It'll get you in there. And you can ask questions directly of us in the upcoming show, which is our live Q&A show. And anything about brewing beer or drinking beer or, well, anything you want to ask, that's fine. We'll cover it. All right. So what we got in the chat today, Justin?
A lot of questions came through. I'll try to keep them. I'm going to try to narrow it down to ones that you definitely covered already, since we're going to split up this topic a little
right.
bit.
Right. If it's something, you know, about anything going forward, then you know, we'll get those in the following shows.
So how about an auto siphon question about siphoning? And this is something that I've always been curious about too. Evan is in the chat room. He says, I get a lot of air bubbles going through the hose, and it seems to come from the seal inside the tube, he says. Is there a way to prime the gasket between the cane and the tube to prevent this? He says, I've got multiple auto siphons and every one of them does it, and so does mine. You get that little bubble spot right at the top.
Where the cane part connects to the hose itself.
Yeah.
What I do is get a smaller vinyl hose, and then I guess what they typically, you know, ship with. And I'll heat up the end of that vinyl hose in, you know, boiling water, so it gets real soft, and I'll slip that on. And that makes a much tighter fit than the nominal size, the ones you can slide on when it's cold. If you go to the next size smaller, it makes a much tighter seal, and you don't get any air. I don't get any air in mine.
So you could maybe do the same with like a clamp then too, right? Sounds like it really just needs to be tight fitting.
Clamp's a little more painful.
Yeah, it does.
The ratcheting effect of the clamp.
Plus it's extra
right.
merchandise.
Break your tube.
Yeah. Right, right. But if you rock that way and you like the look of the stainless clamp,
yeah,
you can do that.
And you like to be able to really kind of ratchet
really
it down.
Really ratchet it down until like nothing comes out.
Yeah.
That works. That works great.
Okay.
Well, and you know the interesting thing is, yeah, I started off with the auto siphon. I think you know my local homebrew shop, More Beer, set me up with the auto siphon and said, you know, this is the thing that everybody uses, and you know, a racking cane, all that. I've tried racking canes and auto siphon. I'm such a freaking doofus that I can't get it to work. I'm just like incapable of using anything other than just a piece of vinyl tubing. So I just use a piece of I snap myself off a fresh piece of tubing and I use that, and I use a turkey baster to start the tubing so I don't have to suck on it. And I use that. And
but do you realize what you're saying, Jamil? That there is something that Justin can do better than you?
I'm not sure about that.
Impossible.
I cannot make it work. I'm just like
Evan's clarifying a little bit. He says it's not happening at the hose connection. He said it's happening inside the tube. There's a rubber gasket between the cane and the tube on his auto siphon.
You know, but if it's down in the beer and it's all filled with beer,
yeah,
and you see bubbles appearing, it's CO2.
Okay.
It's not air. It's not oxygen. It's CO2 coming out of solution. You're pulling. Anytime you have a liquid that's filled with a gas, right? And so you have a liquid. It naturally fills with gases, right? The gases make their way in there magically, and they reach an equilibrium with your surrounding atmosphere. Okay. And when you do fermentation, there's a lot of CO2, and if it's very still, the CO2 doesn't. It's working its way out, but there's still quite a bit of CO2 in the beer, right?
Right.
When you pull on that beer and you create a vacuum, and when you lower the partial pressure of, against that liquid, the gases will come out of suspension, will come out of the liquid, and will form bubbles.
Okay.
And so that's what's happening. You'll see CO2 bubbles form.
Yeah.
Anytime you're pulling on it and you're creating a vacuum, and the gases just automatically come out, and they'll come out instantly.
Okay. All right. Another question. That guy in the chat room he wants to know what you think about getting the beer off the yeast to lager for an extended period of time. He says, is that a conditioning step or a packaging step when you take beer off of the yeast?
Well, all right, so you've waited for fermentation to complete. You see no signs of fermentation. You've given it a couple of extra days. There's still a bunch of yeast in there. Okay, mm-hmm. At that point, I transfer to a keg, a corny keg, and I put it in my fridge for serving. And I start carbonating. Conditioning of beer is really not necessarily yeast-driven. I know there's some, there's conditioning where the yeast are reducing acetaldehyde, diacetyl, things like that.
Yeah.
That's part of it.
Well,
but, when you go really cold, people talk about like lagering at, 32 degrees and all that.
Yeah.
The yeast become far less active. It's not really a yeast thing. It's like, fine particulates dropping out. It's, other actions. It's not really a whole, really active yeast thing. I mean, there is some effect there, but.
Well, I think to clarify a little bit more, lagering is not necessarily a yeast function. It is a clarification function. Conditioning, and I think conditioning the beer, we're usually talking about a yeast-related function, opposed to...
That's why we got Palmer on this show, right here.
So lagering is more of... is more of a physical process where you're working on clarifying the beer, getting tannins, polyphenols, and yeast to settle out and clarify the beer. The conditioning and all the yeast processes to turn that from a green beer into a beer that's more ready to serve, all of that happens up at the warm end, you know, at fermentation temperatures. Especially if you do a diacetyl rest. A diacetyl rest is really a conditioning rest where you're raising the temperature to get the yeast more active to condition the beer to eat up the byproducts.
Right. I've always said that. If you really – what you want to do is reduce diacetyl and things like that, you know, it happens much faster if you warm the beer up and make the yeast more active.
Right.
And I think there's some overlap, you know, a little bit of one happens at, you know, colder and a little bit of the other happens when it's warmer and, you know, there is all of that. But, you know, in general, I think, you know, what you're saying, John, is, 100% correct. It's, you know, conditioning is, you know, that reduction of those compounds happens warmer and better. It happens quicker, warmer. And, you know, settling happens, you know, in these, you know, is really what we're talking about, the long, the cold lagering period.
Right. So, yeah, so that's where his question is kind of, you got to kind of step back and take a look at it from another direction is we want to have these conditioning processes done before we lager, really. The lager, as you say, the way you lager a beer is you let it finish fermentation. And then you stick it in the corny keg and put it in the fridge and carbonate it, because really all you're concerned about at this point is clarification, settling, you know, chilling it, settling the yeast out, settling the tannins out, settling excess protein out for clarity, to clean up the flavor of that beer, you know, and the conditioning has all happened, you know, earlier.
Okay. All right. How about a couple capping questions? We'll get into that.
I don't know anything about capping.
You do them quick.
Sure.
So Maxwell in the chat room says that he's heard from some folks recommending to wait a little while between the time that you place the cap on top of your bottle of beer
and the time
that you crimp it. So he wants to know, you know, if that's accurate to wait, how long should I be waiting, and is this purging oxygen from the headspace?
It is purging oxygen from the headspace because, you know, the transfer of beer into the bottle, it tends to make CO2 evolve out of the beer, and you see a little bit of sparkling at the surface of the beer. That's CO2 coming out, right? And it's going to flush any oxygen out of there. You place the cap on, and the cap kind of trembles a little bit. That's CO2 coming out, and it's pushed all the oxygen out, and then you cap it. And I think that's pretty reasonable, as long as you've got the CO2 to handle it. I wouldn't leave it for a long time and end up with like a, you know, uncarbonated beer. But
yeah, and our oxygen diffusing back in, because it will do that too.
Right. Yeah. Once that stops, then yeah, the oxygen's just going right back in. You know, I don't think it's that critical. I'm really, you know, as far as oxygen goes, I don't give a crap. It's like just jam it in the bottle and.
Yeah.
You know,
cap on foam is a good technique, and it's a good
right.
It seems like if you're capping on foam, the time that it takes you to reach over and grab your capper and crimp it,
it's
is
pretty
enough,
much already
is,
done.
It's probably enough time, right?
Yeah, okay. You know, some people will fill a bottle, put a cap on it, then they'll fill the next bottle, put a cap on it, you know, and seal the first beer, and then fill the bottle, put a cap on it, seal the second beer, you know. So they're like one bottle behind, and they let it sit for the time it takes to fill the bottle and put a cap on it.
Okay.
So it's, you know, it's just like a process thing.
Yeah.
You know, for me, I think the yeast will suck up most of the oxygen really fast, and, you know, again, if you store it cold, you know, oxygen isn't that big a deal either. It takes real abuse for that oxygen to really show up, or a real long storage, or real abuse. And if you're storing your beer warm, then you really need to focus on this. If you're storing your beer cold and you're drinking it within a couple of months, then it's meaningless.
No worries.
Don't even think about it. Worry more about bacteria and all that.
Well, so here's kind of a similar question. Thomas Franson has two kegs with barley wine in them aging. Says he plans to bottle both kegs. and was thinking about sealing the caps with wax.
Mm-hmm.
Will that give his barley wine a better shelf life?
Well, and you know, I would say yes as well. The one thing that concerns me is I don't know the oxygen permeability of wax. That's the only thing. You know, in theory, I think, oh yeah, sure. Oh, that makes sense. And mm-hmm. and Charlie Papazian's a big proponent of this. And I would think if you dip them in wax, it'll seal it. You know, and they use wax for cheeses.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, yeah, it must reduce oxygen, but then maybe not. I mean,
I'd say the opposite. I thought you kind of want some oxygen in your cheese. Maybe that's why they use wax.
I think it maybe it just seals in moisture and allows oxygen in.
Right.
I don't really know how, you know, and I thought Palmer would know how much oxygen various waxes allow. You don't have a wax oxygen chart handy?
I don't. I'll have to whip one up by next show.
Well, that's my question for the next show. I'm calling in.
Yeah.
I want wax oxygen permeability because that's the thing. Otherwise, I mean, wrap it in, you know, Saran wrap or something, or, you know, one of these wraps that's, you know, oxygen proof and twist it at the top, and that's probably better than wax. It's probably a lot easier, too.
Yeah, and but certainly go back to Charlie Bamforth again, you know.
Well, I was Charlie Papazian, you know, I was talking about on the wax, but...
Right, yeah.
And Bamforth says the same thing? No.
Well, no, I was going back. I mean, I agree with you on Charlie and the use of wax as a mm-hmm. is a good way to improve shelf life. But if you go back to the beer oxidation shows with Charlie Bamforth, what he points out that temperature is the prime control there.
Yeah.
You know,
store your beer cold.
Yep. Exactly.
For God's sakes, I've stored beer for 10 years and, mid to 30s. And as sloppy ass as a brewer as I was back then, there's no oxidation.
Yeah.
I've given them to some of the best palates that I know. And these people can pick up oxidation when they, feel the bottle near them.
Yeah.
And they're like, when did you brew this? Last week, They're shocked.
Okay.
So, cold. Pay attention and cold. And I think that oxy caps, good crimping. If you've used your crimper for your what do they call those crimpers?
Hand crimpers?
They have a name for them. Some woman's name for a little two-handled.
Yeah, I don't know it. I didn't know it had a name.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of women's. Bevo crimper?
The Bevo crimper. Oh, yeah. If you take this and you put it on and you crimp. No.
The Jenny.
Yeah.
The Jenny, and you put it on. The little metal cup that's in there, it wears out over time. So over a certain, it's not like, made of titanium here. So this pressed metal cup that's using to press down on these caps, especially if you use a hard, that's a whole nother show. There's some caps that are really hard metal that really take a lot of force, and there's some that are softer and easier, all sorts of different types of caps. Some will wear out your cup quicker and easier than others. And, once your cap's been used a certain amount of times, you would think you should just go and buy another cap and screw it in there. They screw out, and you could screw a new one in. But nobody's going to sell you just the cap. You have to buy a whole new capper.
Okay.
But, keep that in mind. And one thing you can do once you've crown capped that beer is put in a bucket of water and shake the beer around and see if any gas comes out the top of the beer. Emily Capper. There you go.
Thank you to Moby in the chat.
Thank you. That's exactly Emily Capper.
There you go.
Moby wins. And, put it underwater. You know, keep the gas portion at the cap. Don't invert it because then you're not going to see any gas bubbles come out. Gas portion of the cap, shake it underwater and see if any bubbles come out. And you know if your capper is still working properly, and you should check every batch of beer, check one or two bottles and see if any gas is coming out.
All right, I'm going to save Kreuzening and corking questions for the next one. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah.
But maybe we could fit in one about counter pressure bottle filling here?
No.
Save that for the next one too?
Yep.
Okay. Then that's it from the chat.
Because we're at like an hour and 40 minutes.
Well,
on
as
an
long
hour
as you're going to cover counter pressure filling in the
we
next.
Are.
Okay,
we
good.
Are.
Yeah.
We absolutely are. And we want to get all this stuff in detail, and we really appreciate these questions. We appreciate you joining the chat room. You know, you go to that, brewingnetwork.com and chat now. And, we got a show coming up.
Right now.
Live Q&A where we'll answer your questions.
And we get that a lot where people are asking me questions that are off topic during every show.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell them, sorry, but we really got to stay on focus.
Because otherwise we'll never get done.
Look out for these Q&A shows. They tend to be every third show. Yep. And that's when you can ask me anything under the sun about beer, and I'll put it in there.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, while you're at the brewingnetwork.com, you know, check out the store there. Good stuff there. Lots of BrewStrong gear that you can pick up. Shirts. Two kinds of shirts. A hat. I hear rumor they're going to have a thong that's going to have BrewStrong on it. And, all sorts of good stuff. And the bottom line is, any profits from that keep this programming going. So, if you're paying $15 for a shirt, a bunch of it went to manufacture the shirt, but anything that's left over goes to, providing this show for you. So if you like this show, it's worth buying a shirt and supporting that bad boy at all your beer festivals and telling people about the show and about the Brewing Network. And that's really why we do it, because we love you. We love you so much. And also, if you get a chance, Brew Your Own. Great magazine. You can subscribe by clicking on the big BYO logo image on the front page of the Brewing Network. Click on that. It takes you to the BYO page. You sign up for a subscription, and 50% of the frickin' subscription goes to the Brewing Network. Very generous of Brew Your Own magazine. So sign up. I do a regular column in there every month, Style Profile. Palmer does a bunch of stuff for them as well.
I got an article coming up.
Article coming up on oats. And it's good stuff. It's really supportive of the homebrew community and supportive of the Brewing Network. So go sign up. Well worth doing. Until then, brew strong.
Brew strong, everybody.